Hey, Susan, the last few weeks I've been followed online by ads for Noom. So I decided to check it out. Have you heard of Noom before?
I have.
So what caught my eye about Noom is that it's a personalized weight loss plan.
Yeah, most weight loss plans are sort of a one-size-fits-all deal, and that doesn't work when everyone leads such different, crazy, hectic lives. And I know for us, a big challenge of trying to eat right is being on the road a lot and between airports and, me and the hotel breakfast bars.
You do love those breakfast
I
bars.
love those. A little too much. And that's why Noom is great. It addresses your lifestyle, your habits, and finds the issues in your life that are blocking your weight loss goals.
It feels like a personalized weight loss plan to meet everyone's lifestyle. And the best thing about it doesn't seem to restrict what you eat and doesn't shame you when you choose to treat yourself. Hello, Manhattans.
So if you want to get one of those hotel waffles, you're good to go. Look, you're going to have cravings. There's going to be things you want to eat. With Noom, you can. And Noom helps you lose weight while still enjoying your life.
It also looks at your personal psychology. Losing weight starts with the brain, so why not look at your brain to see what would work for you?
Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com and check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
So don't forget, sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. Susan, ButcherBox to the rescue. The other night we had some friends over for dinner and we had no idea what to make. And I was like, guess what? We have a freezer full of meat. So my husband went down and thawed out some chicken from ButcherBox and made the best coq au vin that we've had in a long, long time.
Yeah, you'd have been screwed without ButcherBox because I know you ain't got no time to go to the store right now.
That's true. I don't have time to go shop for meat or pick out the meat or find the best quality, low-priced meat. So ButcherBox does all of that for me.
So, true story, my husband's workplace has a Slack channel called Smoked Meats. And I know you can't like win a workplace conversation, but he is now because with ButcherBox, his great cuts of meat to the door, they can cook up and take photos of for his workmates.
I love ButcherBox, and I think other people would too.
ButcherBox is the ultimate convenience, delivered right to your doorstep, free shipping always, with curated, customized box plans.
It's 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, pork, raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood.
There are a variety of high-quality cuts at an amazing value with exclusive membership deals. They also provide recipe inspiration, guides, tips, and hacks.
Sign up at butcherbox.com/proof and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional 20% off.
Choose salmon, chicken breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/proof and use code PROOF to choose your free for a year offer. Plus, get $20 off your first order. Hello, and welcome to this week's Proof Sidebar. We're here this week with Jacinda Davis and Kevin Fitzpatrick to discuss episode 11 of our series on Cain Story and Lee Clark. Hey, guys.
Hey, Susan, how are you?
Susan.
Doing good. So this week we talked about the Freebirds and whether or not they actually exist. When you guys started the story, what was your take on the Freebirds?
I never thought there was a gang called the Freebirds. And I can't tell you why. It just seems so far-fetched to me. I always thought it was either a band, like a garage band, or just a group of kids, middle schoolers, high school age kids who called themselves the Freebirds.
From what I knew about the story initially, I thought it sounded a little far-fetched that they were an actual gang. And I took it more like maybe they were like a little rascals gang or something like that. And then when I met Glenn Clark and June Story, when I met the parents, that even more solidified that sort of take for me. I just didn't buy that it was an actual gang in the way that we understand the term now.
Yeah, there are groups of boys in Rome in that time period, I'm sure still now, who would like call themselves gangs. Or you'd see people like in a housing complex, the boys there would come together and be like, oh, we're the gang at X block or whatever. When I first looked at this case, I first heard about it and read one of the appeals decision online, I assumed that's what was going on here. And then when I talked to Lee, he's like, no, that whatever the Freebirds were, it didn't involve me. And Lee thought it was like kind of the same as you just, Jacinda, like a garage band or something, or just some of the other boys called themselves that. But whatever it was, he hadn't been one of them.
Yeah, I mean, I always had the sense that it was the term gang got carried away somehow, or it was a convenient term for the prosecution or the police.
Yeah. And still not exactly clear whether a group of boys ever called themselves the Freebirds outside the context of a never came together like garage band. But what is clear is that there's no gang in the sense of boys swearing loyalty to one another and vowing to murder each other if they break their treasured gang rules. That didn't happen.
You know, I think one of the things, Susan, about this episode we hadn't really talked about before is the idea that if you are in a gang, or let's take it, you know, bring it back a little bit, you're not even in a gang, you're just a tight-knit group of friends who plotted to do this, you would actually have to hang out together and be friends with each other.
You'd have to actually meet each other at least once. Like in the case of Joseph Wilkins and Pete Jordan, they didn't even know each other beyond that one day for the safe theft. They weren't even friends, let alone like best buddies.
Yeah, so it would be hard to pledge your loyalty to someone you've met one time.
Yeah.
I do like the story though about Kane and Lee walking through the cemetery and a bird landing on Kane's foot. There's just something very childlike and innocent about that story and how they responded to it. You know, if Lee's right and they're like 11 years old, or, you know, Kane thought they were a little bit older, but that story kind of resonated to me about their boyhood in Rome.
When Kane told me that story, I had an image in my head of, you know, the saying, like a butterfly flaps its wings in the Amazon and there's a tornado in Kansas.
Yes, it sets off a chain of events that leads to disaster.
Yeah. So in this case, you have a random bird that happens to land on a boy and sets off a chain of events that leads to the two boys there serving life in prison.
The sort of idyllic start didn't sort of carry through for those two.
Mm-hmm. And it had been a while after I started talking to Lee Clark before I realized that even Lee Clark and Kane's story, who were and are close friends, they also weren't like the backbone of a gang, or their friendship was not the kind of close friendship I'm imagining. Because they were childhood friends. They grew up together. Their parents knew one another. Their mothers are still friends today. But by the time all this was going on, they weren't hanging out together a lot. They were maybe every other month seeing each other. They were still friends and all, but it was not the kind of friendship that sort of holds up the narrative that the prosecution's going with.
Their lives were very different at this point. Lee had dropped out of high school. He had a girlfriend he was living with. He was working. He was paying his rent when he could, you know, and Kane is still going to high school and performing with the school band. So their lives are very different at this point, and you can see how they're kind of growing apart and going their separate ways.
And Kane is also, was sort of, my impression, immature, relatively. I mean, they all were. But so Kane is 17 when they go to trial, and Lee is same age as Kane. But Brian and Joseph and some of the other boys in this case, they were 15. They were two grades below. Lee was never really hanging with them one-on-one anyway. They were his little brother's age, like his little brother's friends. So they'd hang out, sure, but they weren't tight. It was Kane who had the tight friendships with the younger boys.
And those boys lived over there near Brian, so, you know.
They all lived close together. They were all right there, including Tommy Hyde, who we heard about this episode. And Tommy Hyde seems to have played sort of a background role in this case from the start. And that he was telling people very early on, according to Brian's family, that he thought Lee Clark could have somehow been involved in Brian's death. And then at some point, it's really not clear when, but after the trial, certainly, Tommy starts telling people, including Brian's family, about the story about how some night, he's not really clear when, but like maybe like days or weeks before Brian's death, he and Brian had gotten drunk at Bryn Forsyth's house, and Lee and Kane came over, pulled 9mm on them, and like fired them in the back of their heads, but the guns were empty. There's no explanation for why they would have done this or what was the cause of it. And if this really had happened, there should be some corroborating evidence, and it's just not there.
And it's not something that was used at trial either. This is a story right, that came out at some point, but it wasn't anything that was used to prosecute or convict Lee or Kane.
No, but it made a big impact on Brian's friends and family. And as we also found out, although I initially had not thought that the police had ever spoken to Tommy Hyde, they had. They had interviewed him. And the contents of that interview have never been shared. There's no record of it. We don't know what exactly he told them. And Tommy's the only person I've spoken to still who said, oh yeah, the Freebirds are real, and I was kind of maybe sort of part of it. He says he moved out of the cemetery area before it became real or something, so it's not, the timeline's kind of fuzzy, but he said he was going to be part of it before he moved. So it's possible too that like the cemetery boys that lived right there did call themselves this or something like that. But again, that would not have involved Lee, who didn't live in Silver Creek and was not hanging out with them a lot of that time period. And even if they had called Tommy Hyde at trial, they would have asked him, like, did you guys have a rule book that had rules about what to do? And he had been like, no. Of course that didn't happen.
Right, because he told you there was no rule book that he knew of.
Tommy said that there was no rule book, and he laughed at the idea. He thought it was really funny. he told me, he was like, that sounds like the kind of crap Floyd County would make up if they had to go to jury trial and need to convict someone.
Yeah.
So he knew exactly what that was.
One of the interesting things about this case is that there's all kinds of stories or rumors or myths, whatever you want to call it. And it seems like we can trace the origin, or they actually do exist. The rule book. Was it a song book? Was it a book of lyrics? Was there a gang called the Freebirds? Well, maybe it was a bird that landed. Like, there's some element of truth in all of these things. And I find it really interesting to kind of unravel what the truth is compared to what people have come to believe now.
The only thing of certainty that I've been able to take for a long time is that I do believe a bird landed on his foot. That's about the only thing of certainty I've taken for a long time.
Yeah, I almost wondered if this thing really happened, would Lee even recall that it occurred? And I asked him, I was just, hey, so just wondering, did the bird ever land on you? And he's like, oh, yeah, I do recall that. It made an impression on both boys, it seems, even though Lee was unaware. That's sort of how Kane got this personal mantra of we're free as a bird. But one thing that all the boys in this case seem pretty consistent on is the word narcs, which I found interesting. That's a key word in this case. That's apparently the proof that's why Brian was killed. But all of them told us that the word narcs was not in their vocabulary. Even if they're trying to explain that concept or describe someone doing that, they would never say narcs. They'd say snitch, maybe, something like that. But this word, wherever it came from, does not seem to have been the vocabulary of the boys in Silver Creek.
Speaking of narcs, Susan, how surprised were you when you got a phone call from Joseph Wilkins?
I was pretty surprised because I had tried really hard for a long time, and I was pretty sure he was never going to call because I knew when I talked to his mother that he knew I was trying to reach him, and he still didn't reach back out. So
we were planning to go try to find him, whatever it took, if we had to. But I know that you and me and Kevin, the three of us, we talked about this kid for a long time. Like, how could no one have interviewed him? How could he have not testified? He's so key to the story because I don't think anyone disputes that he drew the note, the weed eagle, and put it in the coffin. What is at question is whether or not he drew the narcs and crossed it out. And it's really shocking that, you know, we're kind of the first people to talk to him.
Except we're not, most likely. I still think there's more.
How about the first people on record to talk to him?
Yes, the first people on record to talk to him. And even at trial, when this comes up, you can like, the judge is, you can tell from the transcript, he is really surprised and a little bit befuddled. Because, they're going through witnesses, they're calling them, and at some point they start discussing the gang stuff and like the Freebirds. And he's like, but you're going to call the boy who drew this note, right? And the prosecutor's like, let me decide that. And the judge is like, okay, but that's kind of weird, right? That you're not going to call him. And then he asks like, well, you did talk to him, right? And the prosecutor's like, I don't remember.
I mean, that's such a huge red flag, even for the defense attorneys. They should have talked to him too. They could have talked to him.
And it seems like at least Kane's attorney subpoenaed him for trial, or someone did, but I don't understand why. I mean, I understand why the prosecution might have not wanted him up there. If they think that possibly he did not write the narcs on that note, then yeah, they're going to stay the hell away from calling him at trial. But then why isn't the defense calling him up there? Are they scared he's going to confirm, like he's going to be like, yeah, we were in a gang? Or like what was the, why not at least talk to him and find out what he would say before deciding not to call him. And it is bizarre and it makes no sense. And I think in reality, he was an important piece of this case from the very beginning, because we know that there was police at the school the day after Brian's funeral. There's a lot of suggestion that it was about Joseph Wilkins. His mother told me it was about him and his connection to this case. And it's nearly inconceivable to me that the police didn't actually talk to him at that time.
It's not clear what the incident at the school was, but there was something about him saying needing protection, or maybe he would need protection, which indicated to me that if the gang theory could have happened earlier than we suspect it, and they thought he would be the next one targeted, or maybe I'm just reading in too much about what he meant by someone asked me if I needed protection.
See, that's my guess as well. Joseph says he does not recall a lot of this. He does not remember the police being there or exactly what the concerns were. And from his point of view, he was 15, like this horrible thing happened. Suddenly he's yanked out of school and sent across the state to somewhere else. His whole life is upended. His parents definitely are concerned for him and trying to protect him, but from what, we're not entirely sure. And also at the same time, in the newspapers, you've got lots of quotes from the investigators, and they're like, yeah, all kinds of crazy-ass rumors are going around town, haha. The community is really upset about these bizarre rumors, which they don't actually spell out. But someone, somewhere, is telling the police about some very strange and weird rumors that have everyone upset. So, yeah, there's still, once again, more questions than answers about a lot of what went on in this investigation. But what is clear is that if they'd actually called some of these people at trial, the ones that should have mattered a lot to the case, things would look very different.
Yeah. It seems from what the conversation is now with Joseph, you know, if he had said the same things he said to you back then, it'd be a very different outcome.
Yeah.
The big thing is, since the beginning, since we first heard about this story, to me, that drawing placed in the coffin was this crucial piece of evidence one way or another. Like, whoever drew that, whoever put narcs on it, whoever put it in the coffin, like, it was always this big thing. They must know a lot. That must tell you a lot about what actually happened. It's his drawing, but he didn't write narcs. And that's a huge part of the story right there.
Yeah.
But he did write Freebirds, which is an indication that Freebirds mattered to someone in this case. So one thing that Joseph did not come outright and tell me is that his motivation for drawing the note, the message to Brian that says, you know, we'll miss you, fly high, see you at the crossroads with the Freebirds banner, it was a gesture from himself, yes, but it was also on behalf of his better friend, Kane Story. Kane couldn't go to the funeral, and Kane had been extremely close to Brian. Joseph and Brian were sort of friends, but they'd hung out, you know, half a dozen times, smoked together. They were friends, yes, but they weren't super close. And the way Joseph explained it to me, it kind of made sense why he would have done this. It wasn't because he himself necessarily would have done it on his own, but he knew that Kane couldn't be there and he wanted to leave something in Kane's honor almost.
Yeah. Have you had a chance to ask Kane if he knew Joseph was doing that for him?
Well, it's not clear when he learned about Joseph having drawn this. Because again, Joseph and Kane did hang out like 7 months later, the following summer. So it's hard to know when they learned about various things. Also worth noting, Kane, after being charged with murder, was released on bond. Lee was not given bond for reasons still aren't clear to me today, but Kane was. So up until trial, even through trial, he was still free, still working a summer job for a little bit, and was out and about, which is how he saw Joseph Wilkins when they were driving to Bojangles together, and when apparently Dallas Battle saw them driving there together.
I mean, it's very clear that if anyone had wanted to question or find Joseph, they could have.
Yes, Dallas Battle affirmatively chose not to speak to Wilkins on the record.
And just to remind listeners, and you know, there's a lot of information in all of these episodes, but Joseph Wilkins apparently asked Deborah Bowling, Brian's mother, if he could put something in the coffin, and even showed her the drawing. And she agreed to it. She said, yes, he could do that.
And she testifies at trial, though, that she even saw the narcs written on it. And she told him, oh, that's a lovely drawing. Go ahead and put it in. But that, if she'd seen the narcs, would she have done that? Also interesting at trial, when Kane gets on the stand and testifies, the prosecutor's asking him, like, was Brian a narc? And he's like, I wouldn't even use the word narcs. The only people I've ever heard use the word narcs was Brian's parents.
I wonder if she would even remember seeing the narcs thing on there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
it's pretty small.
And you're so traumatized and dealing with everything going on, you know, chances are she just glanced at it and wouldn't have noticed every detail.
That's right.
I mean, I looked at it 200 times and never picked out that Brian's name is misspelled on it until someone pointed it out.
Oh, we should mention that. So there's another theory too from some people in the case. On the note, it's addressed to Brian, says, you know, fly high, we'll miss you. But Brian is spelled B-R-A-I-N. And some of Brian's family thought that this was another sort of calling card or
proof that he had been shot in the head intentionally.
Yeah, and it was the boys, the Freebirds' way of bragging they shot Brian in his brain.
I don't know. That sounds sort of presumptuous to me, but
yeah, and I asked Joseph about it, and he said that was just, he has to assume that was a typo. He doesn't remember spelling it wrong, but he was kind of shocked by that. But he didn't remember misspelling at all.
Was there anything when you were talking to him that you sort of had pause, or you just didn't believe him?
You know, at this point, we don't have any records, so I can't say exactly what went on back then. I will say I am not entirely convinced by his lack of memory about what happened very early on with the police investigation. His mother recalled it pretty well, but he says he did not. But he was also pretty clear that, like, this was like a really traumatic thing for him. And he has been carrying around guilt that maybe there was something he could have done or should have done. And he says that he was asking people, like, this is not right. What do I do? And all the adults in his life are telling him, don't rock the boat, just stay out of it, which he did. But I definitely got the sense that he has a lot of regrets over that.
Hey, everyone. Before we continue with this episode, I want to tell you about another podcast. Have you ever wondered what it feels like to watch your house burn down or be attacked by an alligator or learn that your spouse hired someone to kill you? If you're dying to know, then What Was That Like is the podcast for you. What Was That Like is filled with real stories about the most surreal experiences of people's lives. On the show, host Scott Johnson dives deep with his guests into the unbelievable situations they found themselves in, like animal attacks, plane crashes, winning The Price is Right, and more. The show brings you tons of completely surreal, completely true stories, all told through the lens of the person who actually experienced it.
Check out some of these episodes about wild and gripping stories to gain some insight on what it was like to, say, be a professional bridesmaid. Or lose a leg in a shark attack.
Susan, I think you'd be a really good professional bridesmaid.
And you'd be really good at losing a leg in a shark attack.
Oh, gee, thanks.
So if you want to hear some disturbing and inspiring firsthand stories, you need to check out What Was That Like? Every story is thoroughly researched and fact-checked, so you know even the most bizarre tales are someone's reality. Listen to What Was That Like on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you're listening to this show, then I'm going to guess you're a fan of true crime podcasts. So in the mornings, grab your favorite mug and pour yourself a dose of spine-tingling true crime every AM with Morning Cup of Murder. It's a short daily show that's the perfect podcast to incorporate into your morning routine. In less than 15 minutes, you'll hear about a true crime that took place on today's date in history. Each day's dark history lesson will kickstart your morning with intriguing tales of murder, abduction, serial killers, cults, and more.
So, pour yourself a piping hot cup of murder every single morning with Morning Cup of Murder. Find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I think, you know, if he's telling the truth about not writing narcs on there, it's a very different tale that he had.
Yeah.
And that does, of course, raise the question of who did write it. But Jacinta and Kevin, I know you guys have been very busy lately. Working on an exciting new project?
Very busy is an understanding. But yeah, Kevin, do you want to explain it?
Well, so Jacinta and I have been working on a 7-part series that will air on Investigation Discovery and stream on Discovery Plus starting on Sunday the 22nd. 7 hours that will be played over 3 nights. And we have been working on this project for a year, actually more than a year. It's about a year and a half. And we've been sort of really pushing the last few months to sort of get it done. And it's about the murder of the McStay family family of four in California, and the trial of Chase Merritt for their murders. It's a pretty extraordinary story about a missing family and if this man is guilty when they turn up dead. And so it's taken a lot out of us, wouldn't you say, Jacinda?
I would say yes, it has taken a lot out of us. It's a case that when the family first went missing back in 2010, it became headline news around the world. For whatever reasons, this case touched a lot of people. It was maybe two young children were murdered and, you know, their mom and dad. And at the time, no one knew what happened. They just went missing. They literally just disappeared off the face of the earth.
And the official story seems to be from the police that, oh, they went to Mexico.
Right. They thought they had voluntarily left or, you know, voluntarily went missing. So
one of the things that I think sort of spurned such interest in the story is that they weren't found for almost 4 years. So it allowed for people to speculate about their fate. And we all know that people love a good sort of conspiracy theory, right? So that sort of spun out of control, I think. And then when they were finally found, that created a whole new set of conspiracy theories as to who could have done it and why. So it's a very interesting tale, to say nothing of the fact that this project we've got coming out had cameras in the courtroom. And so you can see the tension and the hostility that existed between the prosecution and the defense and the family members. And it is an intense sort of American crime story that I think people will find very interesting. There's a lot of tension and a lot of passion for the people involved.
Yeah, the interpersonal dynamics in this case are pretty wild.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that that a lot of people involved in the case do not like each other. Even people who are members of the same family. I think that this is a story that damaged a lot of relationships for the survivors. And it put a lot of people and their families in crisis, either fighting for their innocence or trying to prove someone's guilt or fighting over someone's legacy. And it is a story about how a crime can really impact a large group of people, and a story about how people will do anything to prove guilt and innocence.
And it probably won't be as big a draw for everyone else, but there's also some pretty interesting cell phone evidence involved.
Yeah.
My priorities.
Now, we debated on whether or not to bring Susan on as a consultant for the cell phone evidence.
Well, you'd need three more episodes just to cover that. So
I know, I was going to say, we didn't want to make it a 20-hour series. Susan, yeah, analyzing every single ping on every cell tower out in California.
Yeah. And look, we've tried to do the show in a way that sort of fairly presents both sides. And we're hoping that the audience will sort of come to some of their conclusions as to what they think happened and guilt or innocence. It's an extraordinary story. I was surprised at how deep it went when it first sort of was first brought to us and we were asked if we wanted to produce it. I guess I didn't realize how rich it was. And as we started to get into it, it's like, boy, you can't even really tell this in 6-7 hours. I mean, there's so much here, and there's so many hard feelings, and there's so much evidence and so much interpretation of the evidence. It's a compelling story. And I think, I'm pretty sure that there were a couple of times where Jacinda was ready to retire while we were making this.
There were many times during this process I thought I should retire.
And I will tell you, actually, while we're recording this right now, the final master is being sort of loaded as we speak, right? Like this is like, we're still working on this.
Well, I've been hearing about it in the background for like a year now. So I'm excited to see the final product.
I'm excited to hear what you think of it, Susan. And, you know,
money laundering. Still think that.
And we can answer any questions about Two Shallow Graves as well on next week's sidebar. So I hope everyone checks it out. It's this Sunday, May 22nd on ID and streaming on Discovery Plus.
All right, what's on next week's proof?
Angela Bruce.
Angela Bruce, the woman who had the party and says she heard Kane and Lee confess. I think a lot of people have been waiting a long time here to hear what she has to say.
Well, I look forward to that because I know that there's some amazing stuff there. So I think the audience is going to enjoy that.
Well, that's it for this week's Proof Sidebar. Thanks for listening, everyone. And we'll be back on Monday with episode 12. If you have any questions for future Sidebar episodes, don't forget to send them our way through email, Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. On all social media, we are Proof Crime Pod. You can find me on Twitter at TheViewFromLL2 and on Instagram at SOOSimp. And you can now find Jacinda on Instagram too at JacindaProof.